Let's say you are a U.S. senator with a seat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and the U.S. president is engaged in military operations in Venezuela. What is your job? You're listening to SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. In Governor Larry Roden's State of the State address this week, he said that South Dakota is punching above its weight in national security. Think of Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem, John Thune as U.S. Senate Majority Leader, the Secretary of the Air Force is a South Dakotan, the next generation B-21 bomber is coming to Ellsworth Air Force Base, and of course we have U.S. Senator Mike Rounds' oversight in areas of the military and cybersecurity. Well, for today's Dakota Political Junkies conversation, I wanted to talk to Lisa Hager and David Wiltsy about political power in today's United States, especially as it revolves around these South Dakotans.
I think, you know, it is noteworthy to mention that we have senators who are very prominent, like Senator Rounds, who's on the Armed Services Committee, obviously Senator Thune as Majority Leader. So we have some people in these key areas where they're learning this information, and then they're able to really weigh in on the future direction of policy.
Yeah. So to get a committee assignment like that is important. Dr. Wiltsy, weigh in on what the job is then once you get that committee assignment.
Well, in a lot of ways, you know, I look at these folks, you know, in Congress, in these key committee positions as kind of highly informed spectators. Hmm. Because there's always been this ambiguity for the role that individuals in Congress have when it comes to these kinds of military actions or law enforcement actions, whatever we're going to call it. There's not a lot in the end that they can force upon the president. There's a few things that they can try, you know, pass a war powers resolution, a few other things to restrain the president on these. But in the end, we're really looking at people who don't really have much ability to put a solid check on what the president's doing. You know, so far we're seeing just a tremendous amount of deference being given to the president on this, as we see in most circumstances like this in the past. The president has a tremendous amount of political latitude here.
So then how come so many people are criticizing Congress for not showing up and doing their jobs and providing a check on the president? What's behind that criticism? Just politics? Or is there something constitutional in there?
I would say it's mostly politics.
Okay.
And when it comes down to constitutionality, you know, let's say we accept this, that this is a military action. And if you're the one who, you know, is making a case that Congress has this sole power of declaring war and authorizing these kinds of military actions, if I were a president, I would just say, well, stop me. You know, how are you going to, in the end, what are you going to do to stop me from doing this? Mm. And, you know, presidents from the very start have actively used the military at a variety of levels, starting in the 1790s, without explicit congressional approval. And Congress has tried to insert itself here and there over the years, but they just haven't been able to really put any kind of teeth to the oversight that they have. They can ask questions, they can investigate, ultimately they can appropriate and reappropriate things, but that's a very sticky position to be in politically.
Yeah. Lisa, would you add anything to that, that sense of a highly informed spectator but not really having a lot of authority to check the president's military actions here?
I would completely agree with what Dave mentioned. We often see exactly what he's describing, where presidents are taking these actions. Congress is often sitting on the sidelines, watching what's happening, then trying to respond, whether it be the War Powers Resolution or others. But yeah, they're often stymied by the fact that there's just precedent on the president's side of things of this is how things generally work, and Congress doesn't have a lot of ways to really fight back, so to speak. And the Supreme Court, whenever they get cases that deal with these types of issues, either don't hear them because they declare them political questions, mm-hmm. or they defer to the president, which then leaves Congress with only the power of the purse to fight back. And like Dave said, that's a sticky situation to be in, because do you really want to be defunding the military in any particular way? That's not good in general, but then it's also not good for your districts.
Right. And it's also really bad to do it to a force that's deployed in a combat situation.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
That's not happening.
That would be a non-starter.
So yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So when the president says we're going to run Venezuela, that, you know, those were his words. What does that mean at this point? Like, what happens next? What are we watching for as Americans?
I mean, it's basically so far being tried to pressure Vice President, now acting President Rodriguez, to do what the Trump administration wants. And mm-hmm. so that's really what we're watching for, to see exactly whether or not she really kowtows to the Trump administration. So, you know, Trump is pressuring her. She's had some statements where she's been critical, but we just kind of have to see what happens there.
Yeah, this is just flying by the seat of your pants right now. We have no idea what this is going to look like. You know, we're certainly seeing some departures from previous attempts at decapitating regimes or a full-on regime change. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're making this as they go. And we're just along for the ride on this one.
And therefore, the consequences of if, say, for example, the American public sours on the mission for whatever reason, or something terrible goes wrong, American troops come back in body bags, for example, or America's reputation as followers of international law is tarnished, and that impacts our relationship with our allies. Do those consequences also end up at the feet of the president?
Yeah, certainly. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a political price to pay if mm-hmm. things really do hit the fan there. And, you know, I will say that the administration is doing a pretty good job kind of navigating and hedging against this, largely by keeping most of the regime intact. So we don't have a situation where we're starting from ground zero like we were in Iraq or in Afghanistan. Mm. So, I mean, I think that's a very deliberate choice that they've made. One, to kind of steer clear of any accusation of, you know, promoting regime change, which Trump has explicitly campaigned against time and time again. And this, you know, doesn't qualify really as a regime change. We've had a change in leadership, but not a complete reorganization of government there. But what kind of coercive techniques he's going to use to try to get the policy ends that he wants, that's anybody's guess.
So what about these operations? Let's switch now to the Department of Homeland Security. And we all, I think, are fairly aware what is happening and has happened in Minnesota with ICE operations there. Here you have federal agents directly in conflict with the state governor, and this back and forth between Tim Walz and Kristi Noem about what mm-hmm. should be happening with these enforcement operations on the ground. Help us understand the dynamics between those two agencies. Who wants to begin?
I can take that. So basically what we're really seeing play out here is federalism at its finest. And just in this particular instance where you have federal ICE agents who are the ones tasked with immigration enforcement coming into a city where then you have a state and a city that are relatively resistant to that, and everything that just ends up happening in light of the politics surrounding that.
Yeah, this is turning into almost a purely political fight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those who know me know I've, you know, been based largely in the Twin Cities for the last 30 years. So this, you know, really strikes home to me mm-hmm. In a lot of ways. So take that caveat.
On all of
this stuff, because this really is pretty troubling for someone who has, you know, this kind of connection
right.
To the cities. But, you know, from the start, it's clear that this was about politics at every step of the way. If you watched the press conference, I think it was yesterday, when the attorney general and the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul had the press conference announcing their lawsuit against the DHS, they really spoke to, you know, the political targeting and the political ends that the administration is trying to make here. This is all about politics right now, and it's anybody's guess as to where the courts are going to find ultimately on this question of the use of these federal law enforcement officers for some very ill-defined goals.
Lisa, what would you add? What would you add there? First of all, I'm just sorry that, you know, I have family in Minneapolis. I was born in Minneapolis. So there is a depth of agony in the community, and I just want to express that to you. Lisa, what would you add to the complexities of this? I'm having a hard time just accepting it's politics as an answer.
I think it definitely is politics to a certain extent, because if you look at some of the various folks who are weighing in on the Trump administration's performance with respect to immigration, there's a lot of questions about whether or not they really are living up to some of their campaign promises with respect to this. So a lot of what we're seeing numbers-wise ends up reflecting more of political, you know, I wouldn't say like theatrics is the right word, but, you know, trying to get these high profile sorts of operations taking place without really then saying that the numbers are kind of backing up what they're accomplishing there. So it's more about having the events take place than it is about being able to report, you know, high number of deportations.
Yeah. And if you just look at the raw numbers, and, you know, if you look at the proportion of foreign born residents, Minneapolis and St. Paul actually have pretty low numbers compared to a lot of other cities out there. And to explain it, you know, solely on an immigration enforcement level is absurd. To the targeting of the Somali community is also really off base. I mean, if you know the history of the Somali community in Minneapolis, most came in the 1990s. Most got their citizenship in the late 1990s, early 2000s, or were born in the cities. So most of them are citizens already. So it's not even an immigration issue at heart. I mean, this really is a political targeting.
So if I'm a student in your class, and I've come out of high school civics believing that there are three branches of government that check each other, that we have civil rights in our society, and then we're doing a current events, you know, class or discussion or time of the day, we're all talking current events. And I'm just getting confused because I'm like, nothing prepared me that 90% or 95% or 99% of what I would be engaged in as a citizen was just politics, that everybody on this side of the flag red and they're going to see it like this, and everybody over here who votes blue is going to see it like this. Mm-hmm. It makes it feel like there's no infrastructure that's holding this whole thing up. It's just how we see politics and who has the power to do things to the other person. And that can't be right, Lisa. So help me figure out then, as a high school student, how to grow up into the, you know, the big world of American federalism.
Yeah, so the one thing that I would say is, of course, we are taught the checks and balances among the three branches of government and the federalism system and all of those sorts of things. But unfortunately, the reality is that there's some things that maybe we don't think about, like we talked about earlier today, that the president has pretty much unrestricted power when it comes to foreign policy areas versus they're much more restrained when it comes to domestic policy. So a lot of those relationships that were taught early on are much more refined once we actually start digging into them. So I would say that. I would say, you know, one of the biggest developments, and maybe it's not even a development anymore, it's happening, is political polarization. So you have polarization, and then that leads to really divided government in at the federal level. So then what do you have? Gridlock. You constantly have this fight. You know, there's no benefit to compromising under political polarization. So I think polarization has really impacted a lot of those typical relationships that we talk about in American politics in ways that we maybe necessarily didn't anticipate when we were thinking about putting this structure together to try to have checks and balances and try to make change difficult. Mm-hmm. But now polarization is almost making things impossible. And that's not necessarily what the framers were trying to have happen.
Impossible, assuming that we have divided government. But the thing about all of these institutional checks is that they are all conditioned on each actor being willing to employ that check. And when you're in a situation where two of the three branches are basically writing a blank check to the others, there's nothing inherent about the Constitution that's going to restrain the president if he can get away with these things politically. These are not automatic. They are in the Constitution, but they're only effective when they are employed. And they are not always employed, as we're seeing now. And this is just so especially harmful in the realm of foreign policy now, since we've become a lot more polarized on foreign policy. Mm-hmm. 40, 50 years ago, we did not see this kind of polarization when it came to foreign policy. And most Americans held a number of assumptions, a number of shared values that really gave continuity between administrations and over the decades. And when you look at some of the things that are going on now, kind of in the broader foreign policy realm, whether it be Venezuela, all this nonsense about Greenland, they were all dependent upon this old consensus that's gone. And now we have this institution that is tremendously empowered through years of precedent and through the Constitution itself, and we don't share that consensus any longer. It's going to be very damaging to our interests in the long term.
So hypothetically speaking, if the President of the United States says, I want to own Greenland, I want to take it over, some of that he has said that he wants to, you know, take it over. But hypothetically, if he took military action to do that, let's say, where is the check on that happening? If the people of this country are like, well, we don't want that to happen. Mm-hmm. If Congress is like, this is a terrible idea. If there was some kind of groundswell that said, no, we don't want a president to take that action. What is the pathway to push back against that? Or is this president in a position of power to where for the next 3 years, he can do almost anything that he wants to at this point?
Yeah. Well, we're seeing some pushback in Congress from Republicans on Greenland already. I mean, there have been a number who have stood up and, you know, said, this is crazy. You know, we cannot do this to an ally. Not only are we under a treaty obligation to defend Greenland, we can defend Greenland however we want under that treaty. So we see some pushback. But we also had a resolution put into the House yesterday authorizing it. So again, it really does come down to members who are pushing back. And if the president sees this as too politically damaging, if it's ripping apart the caucuses in the House and the Senate, he might back down. And I think that really ultimately is the only restraint on him right now. And he said in that New York Times interview, you know, the only restraint I have is my own morality.
Right. Is that true? The only restraint is the president's own morality?
I mean, I would disagree in the sense that, like Dave said, if you have the caucus tearing itself apart, what does that also start to get at? Well, that you don't have that support from your own party. And if you're pushing on some of these types of issues, like running a country, taking over a country, what's going to happen? You could find yourself in impeachment proceedings and have a better chance of actually being removed from office.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I was kind of preparing for this, you know, my ultimate takeaway was, you know, if things get bad enough, I would say the ultimate check is impeachment more than dealing with any of these possible scenarios getting talked about with respect to international law, because I think it's highly unlikely that we see President Trump or any of our officials going before international courts.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And that's one of the reasons why in most other democracies, impeachment isn't, or, you know, a removal of confidence by a parliament against a prime minister isn't as dirty of a thing as it is here.
Yeah.
Here, we're just accustomed to this being, you know, a very, very, very last resort and never being fully, fully employed. Whereas in, you know, a lot of other countries around the world, you know, they remove executives on a semi-regular basis, which is, you know, just kind of the ultimate check.
Yeah. So, hypothetically, Senator John Thune, Secretary Kristi Noem have lunch, and they're talking about ICE operations. Does he have any influence, leverage, power over her to sort of say, hey, I think that you should think about this. Go here, don't go here. Is that just a collegial relationship, or is there any authority?
I would say it's purely collegial. He would only have, you know, his own powers of persuasion in that situation. And, you know, he would, you know, if he really thought that, you know, this was harming the party, he would make it very clear as to how it's harming the party and how it's going to harm the party long term.
Yeah. So speaking of the party and divisions, we have not talked about Representative Dusty Johnson, who is running for governor and is navigating a sort of balance beam on his way from Washington, hopefully to Pierre. Mm-hmm. What sorts of things does he have to do? And he's running, of course, in a primary against Governor Roden and Lieutenant Governor Van Huysen. How do you survive that without damaging the South Dakota Republican Party too much? But yet it's a primary. So what does a robust primary look like? And somebody leaving Washington, coming to Pierre, trying to hold up the party in Washington, but also say, I'm ready for the governor's office. What are some of the nuances that he's considering right now?
Well, he's lucky in the sense that there's not nearly as big of a difference between the national party and the state parties as there were 30, 40 years ago.
Right.
It used to be
if he was a Democrat, yeah.
Or certainly if he was a Democrat. You know, so it's. I don't think it's as tough of a balancing act as some might try to cast it. I mean, you'll hear claims, oh, he's been in Washington too long, he doesn't understand South Dakota, you know, all that kind of nonsense. And you see that whenever you have someone who has been serving in Congress come back for, you know, a state-level position.
Right.
I mean,
if you had lunch in D.C., somebody might say you've forgotten what it's like to live in
South Dakota. Yeah. Did Kristi Noem forget what it was like to be South Dakotan when she was serving in Congress? No, of course not.
Right.
And she's not going to forget about what it means to be a South Dakotan now. So so many of these divisions we're seeing within the parties really don't come down to policy per se and sharp policy differences. It's largely a matter of style. And I think the thing that's going to be trickiest for him, and for any of these guys really, is to not irritate the Trump base of the party here in South Dakota. Mm. And that's the, you know, and they don't want to draw the ire of Trump, because as soon as they do that, you know, he'll take to Truth Social and just lambaste them. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say that's a career ender, but it's going to make their career a lot harder in the end. I mean, we saw this with Marjorie Taylor Greene. We see this with a few others who are just unwilling to even try to push back against the president in these situations. So he's going to be walking that tightrope of, trying to be a good representative, and I mean, in all manner, he really is. I mean, he's an institutionalist, he's deep into policy, but he has to navigate that reality of the modern Republican caucus, or not the caucus, but the electorate, and that could be a little tough and you might see him treat, you know, the president with kid gloves on some of these things, like Greenland, Venezuela, etc.
Yeah. Lisa, what would you add anything about Dusty Johnson at this point and what he needs to do to run effectively against Larry Roden, especially seeing his experience in Washington right now?
I think one thing that can set Dusty Johnson apart from Governor Roden is, one, by focusing on South Dakota issues when he is doing his campaign activities, which so far I've seen him really doing that. Mm-hmm. So like Dave's saying, you know, distance yourself from some of these high-profile political issues at the federal level that then get people casting votes or potential votes, you know, at least formulating decisions about you based on some of those issues rather than what your plans are for South Dakota. And I think just, again, trying to stay out of any of those issues. I think Governor Roden sometimes currently has been attempting to play into some of the national political arena with certain comments and policy moves that he's mm-hmm. taken. And so I think if Dusty really focuses on South Dakota, like recently I've seen him talking about things relating to economic development and things relating to funding for education and healthcare and so on and so forth. I think focusing in those areas gets you away from the national conversation, which I think could be harmful, especially just anecdotally. I've been hearing some comments about how some folks are thinking about switching their party registration from Democratic to Republican to vote mm-hmm. in the primary because they think that's where the most competitive race is going to be for selecting the future governor of South Dakota. So I think, you know, that's another consideration of potential voters who might be, you know, making some decisions that you wouldn't normally anticipate.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. What else is on your mind? Like, first, Lisa, what else is on that piece? Three pages of
notes. I mean, the one thing was I just wrote down some more about some of the international law types of things
yeah.
and some of these issues with treaties, just to kind of get at this idea that there's been discussions about treaties. We know that treaties are considered part of the supreme law of the land when we're talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
And we expect the presidents to implement them, you know, just like they would any other law at the federal level.
Until they decide not to and
right.
exit the treaty.
Exactly. So. Like, we right. have very little Supreme Court guidance on this, but ultimately, when you start thinking about what Dave said, like, the president possibly just doesn't continue implementing it, well, then mm-hmm. can the courts really enforce that? Because there's case law where it either has to be self-implementing or Congress has to then create legislation that implements it.
Mm-hmm.
So it really just seems like the president can still just keep doing whatever they want with respect to that, which that just continued to lead me to that conclusion that it's impeachment that will eventually, if there is going to be an eventually,
right.
keep the president in line.
Right.
It's not
hypothetically
going
yeah.
to the
yeah.
Supreme Court
no.
and hoping
mm-hmm.
that they make some sort of huge landmark decision yeah. on this.
And what we're seeing from Congress is that this president is nowhere near.
Not even close.
Impeachable.
Yeah, yeah no.
This
yeah,
is not a
I
group of people who think, I mean, they're largely supportive of these actions, and so are many Americans, to be fair.
Yeah.
I guess
right.
I'm trying to get this idea of power and influence because this is not the only part of President Trump's entire existence has been to demonstrate the power of the presidency. And
mm-hmm.
I think it could be argued that he has demonstrated the power of the presidency, and that has set up a precedent mm-hmm. for future presidents to do sweeping actions to make mm-hmm. policy, to bring changes to America in a very fast way that maybe we're not used to, but in a very whiplash fashion as well.
Yeah.
If we remain divided, we're just going to go back and forth between this and this and that and that. It's a
yeah.
mm-hmm. it's
and
dizzying.
We've had a court majority slowly building
mm-hmm.
Over the past 25 years of people who share that idea of presidential supremacy.
Right.
Which,
which just doesn't go.
I don't know what
founding away with the new
documents
president.
They were reading. I don't know which constitutional convention they were watching, or which Federalist Papers they were reading, but that just doesn't jibe with our founding principles. I mean, even Alexander Hamilton, I reread his famous speech. You know, I think it was, I can't remember what date it was in June. It was fairly early on in the convention. I mean, even he would be backing up from what's going on here.
America, 250 years.
But that is now the majority.
Yeah, America.
But that is now the majority on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
What do you do in that circumstance? Not a lot.
So America at 250 years, we're rethinking. And I know I haven't read Jill Lepore's book about the U.S. Constitution, but this argument that I saw in interviews with her that maybe the Constitution itself is a little bit too hard to amend, that you know, we have a court that's looking back at what the founders intended, and perhaps there should be a more impactful way for states to say, we want this amendment or that, for the people to, I'm not saying I agree with that or disagree with it, largely because I haven't read the book, but this concept of our underlying structure of how we govern ourselves after 250 years.
Yeah, and we were relying so heavily on norms back then, which a lot of people are forgetting. And when you rely on norms and 240 years pass, well, those norms are going to change a lot.
Yeah.
And it can lead to a constitutional absolutism where, you know, people take the opinion of, well, the Constitution doesn't prohibit me from doing this, so how are you going to stop me?
Yeah. So elections become more important or less important to the college students in your class because they are throwing up their hands and saying, I don't like any of this. Or are they more engaged saying, well, listen, it's we the people, and we the people better show up and be part of this dialogue? What are you seeing in the classroom?
I've not really thought about it on these terms before.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll be honest with you. In a lot of ways, I kind of avoid some of these most pressing current events in the classroom simply because it doesn't always lead to the most constructive of conversations. Mm-hmm. So I would have a hard time answering that question.
Yeah. You know, for me, when we do talk about current events, it's more about trying to unpack them in light of what we're learning. So a lot of how we talk on this show. So it's not about, you know, what do we do if we do or do not like what's going on necessarily. Although, of course, elections are going to be important. You know, voicing your right to vote or exercising your right to vote, you know, those are important things. I haven't heard from students where they are expressing this, let's throw up our hands and just, you know, give up or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And when they're talking about issues, they seem concerned about them and wanting to understand them. And, you know, I think a lot of the viewpoints I get is like, you know, regardless of whether we agree or disagree with what's going on, we don't see a lot of progress with respect to policy. And so a lot of them are wanting to see progress. And so I don't see that as a let's throw up our hands and not be involved. I see it as we need to find constructive ways to be involved. And that's part of why I'm in this classroom is to try to understand, you know, how the sausage gets made and what's the right career move for me. Yeah.
And I think in so many ways we are moving to a much more majoritarian system.
Mm-hmm.
So the consequences of elections are going to matter a lot more. And like you said, you know, there's this whiplash going back and forth. We used to have, you know, some pretty strong norms in Congress and some realities and, you know, just the way that the parties were internally divided in Congress that, you know, gave more continuity between sessions. But now, you know, we see a Congress that's willing to just turn on a dime as soon as the majority changes and, you know, just rewrite rewrite policy. We see the same thing on the, you know, on the Supreme Court, where they're willing to go back to precedent that was established just 2-3 years ago, and tear it up and go the opposite direction.
Right.
That's not healthy for democracy. And like I said, it's just more majoritarian, and being the political minority is going to be worse and worse and worse under this kind of a system. And, you know, worst case scenario is we devolve into what comparativists call competitive authoritarianism. where whoever wins the election is going to come in, smite their enemies, and hope that they hold on to power the next time around. And that's no way to run a democracy.
I think that's a good place to wrap up. You've been more than generous with your time, you guys. Thank you so much.
Yeah, anytime.
David Wiltsy is a professor of political science. Lisa Hager is associate professor of political science, and both teach at South Dakota State University. That's our conversation for today. I hope that it served you. All throughout the legislative session, this is the place for timely and thoughtful political analysis. The Dakota Political Junkies are a rotating panel of political scientists, journalists, and state political leaders. Download, subscribe, like, comment, and share to be part of the conversation. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in Pierre.